I am Jean M. Owl. I am the author of the Earth's Children series, which began with The Clan of the Cave Bear. There's actually 6 books in the series. It took me about 30 years to write them. It starts with The Clan of the Cave Bear, and then it's The Valley of Horses, and The Mammoth Hunters, and The Plains of Passage, and The Shelters of Stone, and The Land of Painted Caves.
It's an amazing collection.
So, and as I said before, my husband estimated that there's 1,750,000 words in that series. And if I wrote normal size books that were like 100,000 words, I'd have 17 books instead of 6.
One of the things we've been fascinated with in talking to writers is how they began as writers early on. What led them into the world of reading and literature, books, writing, whatever it might be. And I have to add to that with you specifically, did you always have an interest in ancients?
No, not at all. No, that interest has come from the research that I did for these books.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, I started out, I've always loved to read. And actually, I repeated kindergarten. Because basically I went to one school in Chicago. I was born in Chicago. And then we moved, and I was a year younger than kindergartners are supposed to be. But they were ready to pass me into first grade. But then we moved, and so I had to go to a different school, and they wouldn't let me go into first grade. So I had to repeat kindergarten. And I kept wanting to read. And I'd ask, when am I going to learn to read? And they said, when you're in first grade. So I thought, okay. So I start my first day of first grade, and I come home from school, and I'm crying, and I'm telling my mother. My mother says, what's wrong? And she said, and I told her, I'm in first grade, and I don't know how to read yet. So, but I learned pretty quick. I really did, you know, when you want to. And so I was then checking books out of the library, you know, all kinds of things. I used to love to read fairy tales, except my favorite one was one called East of the Sun and West of the Moon.
Yes.
And I think part of the reason for it is, now when I look back at it, it's a book where the woman is the hero. You know, I mean, actually... Yeah. When you think about it, it's the man who gets captured and is held by the witch.
Yeah.
And she has to go save him. And I never thought of it. I never put it together like that. But even when I was a little girl, I thought, because, you know, when I was a little girl, I could never identify with the women in the books because they were, help, save me, you know. And I wanted to be out there snick-snicking with the hero, you know. I can sword fight, too, you know.
Yeah.
Basically, I've been, you know, read all the time. I mean, I'd walk down the street and read a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated from high school. 1954 was a very important year for me. You know, I graduated from high school. I got married. I got pregnant. I moved to New Mexico because my husband was in the Air Force. And then I had a baby.
Jeez.
All in 1954, you know. So I got married and I had 5 kids before I was 25. Mm-hmm. In like little over 6 years, about 6 1/4 years.
Right.
So, and I was, you know, when you have that many children, you know, one income doesn't cover it always. So I was usually, besides that, it was more than that. I couldn't just be a housewife and a mother, because I needed more intellectual stimulation than mm-hmm. that. You know, I loved my children, but their conversation didn't stimulate me a lot.
They,
you know?
They don't.
And so, basically, you know, I started working full time, and then I was going because my husband went to school on the GI Bill when he, you know, got out. And then I was 28 and I decided it was my turn to go to school. And at that time, what I decided I wanted to study was I wanted to be a physicist. And the reason for that is that when I was in school, they didn't teach women how to do things or how things worked.
Right.
And I figured, if I want to know how things work, I need to take physics. Excuse me. And in order to understand physics, I needed the math. So I started with algebra, and I studied algebra, trigonometry, analytical geometry, differential and integral calculus, got into differential equations, did some physics, took some physics classes, took some electronic classes, even took some Russian.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was also on the side taking astrology classes. Not astronomy, but astrology. Because my interests are always been wide-ranging, and it was interesting, you know.
Right.
So I worked at Tektronix I worked a lot of jobs, okay. Mm-hmm. And then, as I say, because the engineers would come and ask us where the stuff was and how to get started, and that would be an interruption for what we were doing. And so I wrote this little instruction manual. So you want to design a circuit board.
Your first book.
My first book, right.
Love it.
My first writing pamphlet. And I tried to put in there everything that they would need, you know, and we'd still have to go and help them, but at least it'd be a little something for them. So then my boss said, how would you like to write instruction manuals, you know, do technical writing? And so I started to be a technical writer and did that for something a little over a year. And then about end of January 1976, I got this idea for a story. Now, this is what I've been leading up to the whole time.
No, we can't just rush that fast. You got this idea for a story.
Yes.
Were you in the shower when you got the idea?
No, it was on my mind all day.
Huh.
And it was of this young woman who was living with people who were different.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't mean just, you know, different color hair or different color skin, but substantially different.
Morphologically different.
Well, intellectually different even,
yeah.
You know. And so I thought, well, about 11 o'clock at night, my husband's going to bed, or 11:30, which is after the news. And he said, come to bed. And I said, well, wait a minute. I want to see if I can write a story. I'm going to see if I can write a short story. You know what? Apparently I can't. You take a look at those books. You know. That's
these,
the shortest
tomes.
One. Yeah, that's the shortest one, actually.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
200,000 words.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the last one was like 315 or 20,000 words.
So this is the short story.
Yeah, that's the short story.
Yeah.
And then, but what happened is that, so I started to write it. And I basically started out with a pencil, you know, on a tablet. And very quickly, you know, I realized that I didn't know what I was writing about. You know, I was going to have this girl she was staying with an old man who she was taking care of, and that's why they were letting her stay, even though she was different.
And this was Paleolithic times.
I wasn't sure. It could have been in the beginning. It could have been on a different planet for all I knew.
Uh-huh, okay.
You know, the idea was of the
yeah.
characters. But I did kind of think that it was prehistory, because when I decided to check out, and you know, I wanted to find out something. Because when she was going to go and get this guy a drink of water. How do you get a drink of water? They didn't have ceramic cups. They didn't have tin cups, you know. So how do you bring somebody a drink of water? You know, do they lay down on their stomach and lap it up like an animal or what, you know? So I said, well, I need to find out some information. So I got Encyclopedia Britannica, and I started going through that. And that gave me, first of all, it gave me the time frame. And because I found out that there really was a time, certain scientists believe, when two different kinds of humans were living in the same place at the same time.
Mm.
And it was in Europe during the Ice Age. And not everybody believed that, you know, because, you know, right. You know how it goes with archaeology. You get this, and then you get here, and then you go here, and, you know. I mean, right now, Neanderthals are coming back into their own. But for a while there, they were really, I mean, and of course, people think about Neanderthals as cavemen, the way Hollywood. I mean, how many of us have learned about early ancestors from the movies?
That's right.
And they're dead wrong, you know.
That's right.
Anyway, so basically what happened is that I started this idea, got the encyclopedia, and that, you know, the trouble with the encyclopedia is either it gives you more than you want if you just want a little quick answer, and not enough if you really want something in depth.
Right.
But it did give me some names, you know. Upper Paleolithic.
Mm-hmm.
Pleistocene, Neanderthal, Mousterian, Cro-Magnon, you know, these are terms and stuff. Mousterian just describes the industry or the kinds of stone tools that Neanderthals made. So that if you say Mousterian, you know you mean Neanderthals.
Mm-hmm.
And then there have several names. You know, there's the Aurignacian, which is the earliest of the Cro-Magnon, or the modern. They were anatomically modern humans.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like us. They were like you. They were really, you know, 6'6" and intelligent, and as I said, they were the highest culture of their time.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we are now, somebody can look back and say that was primitive times, but in their time, they were the ones who invented art.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I get so angry when somebody wants to cut out the art and music programs from the schools. You know?
It's our roots.
It's who defines us.
That's right.
I mean, that's who we are, for heaven's sake. We're the ones who invented art.
Mm-hmm.
That's the earliest art. I mean, they have found, you know, like scratch marks on some stuff from the Neanderthal period, but there's never been any figures or anything like that. What the research told me was how much there was that we didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, I just kept saying, how come we don't know this? How come I don't know this? How come?
An immense block of time.
Yes. And also, stuff, you know, the stuff they found, stuff that they, I mean, what is it? Paleoanthropology is the bones, the people. Archaeology is the stuff, you know, sometimes the garbage. You look at a midden heap, you know,
mm-hmm.
but you can find stuff out from stuff like that. We actually worked at a dig for only about a week in France,
mm-hmm.
but I wanted to have some idea how they do this. So we had this little square, meter square, and we were next to a wall, so we didn't have a full meter. Ray and I were both working on it. And I found some Aurignacian. That's my period, you know, because I'm at the period when the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnon were living together,
mm-hmm.
you know. There was, in Israel, there was about 60,000 years.
Right.
And in Europe, at least 10 to 15,000 years, where
yeah.
they were coexisting. And you know that they had to know of each other. And they might have had different cultures and a different way. Because, you know, they're... And that's what I was trying to... That's a lot of what my research was. How were they different from us? Who were these Neanderthals?
So you must have felt terribly justified when the DNA evidence came
back.
God. That
you
must have been dancing around here going, I told you.
You know, I'll tell you better.
Yeah.
I was in London doing some promotion for this last book.
Uh-huh.
And Chris Stringer is the guy at the Natural History Museum there, the Museum of Natural History in London.
One of my favorites.
And he's a wonderful guy. He's
yeah.
written. But he has always said, oh, no, they were not into breeding, absolutely not into breeding. You know, the thing about scientists like that, they can disagree, and they can agree to disagree, and
right.
that's fine.
Right.
You know? So he still liked my books, you know. And there were several of the scientists who said, well, you use so-and-so's idea, and he's wrong. But at least they knew where I was coming from,
right.
you know. And so it was really kind of an interesting thing, because they set up this program where Chris and I were both on the stage, and there was this audience, and Chris got up and the first thing he said is, "I was wrong and she was right." Now, that's a scientist. That's somebody who can look at information,
right,
and you know, go with it and understand it.
Yeah.
Unlike Hollywood, my feeling is, if you can make it accurate and exciting, or are not accurate and exciting, why not pick accurate? You know? So I've always tried to make mine as accurate as I could, you know.
So this began as a short story, this one night.
Yes.
That then evolved into a long research project.
Well, I Encyclopedia Britannica gave me those terms, you know. And so I said, well, I'm going to go to the library. I came home with 45 or so books.
Oh, my God.
You know, I mean, I kept finding something. Oh, that would be in it. And they were books about... some of them were very, you know, obtuse,
mm-hmm,
archaeology books. Some of them were about people who have lived with native peoples, you know. There was a guy who lived with the Inuit or the Eskimos for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
There were books about, like, the White Lions of Timbavati. So, anyway, so that I got home with those books and I started reading. And immediately got out the yellow lined paper, you know, and started taking notes. And I actually read all the books, I mean, just one right after another. And by then the story had grown, because, you know, there's all this interesting stuff, you know. I mean, like, they talked about this collection of objects that was found at a Neanderthal level. And there was, like, a piece of iron pyrite. That's iron pyrite,
mm-hmm,
up there.
Mm-hmm.
There was a what they call a fossil cast of a gastropod. In other words, it's like a shell that's filled in with stone because it's so old, it's become fossilized. There was a piece of red ochre. There is a piece of black manganese dioxide. Those are both coloring agents, and they were all together. And it was suggested that they may have been in something where they were carried around. I mean, that had long since disintegrated.
Right.
So that became the basis for Ayla's amulet, right? I mean, what great ideas, you know, I could get from this research.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I had to make up part of the story of what those things meant for her and stuff, you know. But at least the very basis of it is based on something real, you know. And that's what I like to do. I mean, you get ideas from doing the research. And I would work 7 days a week, every waking hour, you know. Now, I don't work at that pace anymore because I really can't. I'm getting old. I was about 40 when I started.
Yeah. You've sold over 40 million copies?
It's closer to 60 now.
Is it closer to 60?
You know, I mean, 45 was when the last one, before it came out.
Oh.
So.
Awesome.
So it's 55 million, 60 million, something like that.
Wow.
You know, because when I got through with all of the reading all those books, then I sat down at my typewriter, because it was my husband who said, "Why are you doing it by hand? I have a terrible handwriting to start with. Why don't you? You know how to type." "Yes, I know how. I learned touch typing."
Right.
You know, I worked 8 hours. I worked a full-time job. I raised 5 kids. I went to school at night. And writing is harder than that, you know.
Every writer we've spoken with, that's what they tell us.
Of course.
It's work.
And I hate it when somebody says, "Oh, I always wanted to write a book. Have you ever read a book?" "No, I just wanted to write one." "Yeah, right."
Have you had the one? We have had a number of writers who said, they keep getting approached by people who say, I have the best idea for a bestseller.
Yeah,
will you write it for me?
Yeah, and then we'll split the profits.
Right, we'll split the profits. 50,
50, sorry, thank you, no. No.
Oh.
Writing is hard work.
Yeah.
And fiction writing is harder than nonfiction.
Yeah, there'd be some nonfiction writers that might argue with you.
Well, but I've talked to people who have done both.
Yeah.
And they will tell you fiction's harder than nonfiction.
And that's because...
I'm not sure, but it's because nonfiction, if I have to write a speech or a talk, that's much, much easier to do than writing the fiction. Fiction, you have to pull it all out of yourself, you know, and that's really what you do. You just, you know, who was it that said fiction writing is easy? You just split a vein and bleed all over the page.
Something just crossed my mind, again, perhaps one of these total asides. It's always fascinating that Russian literature, like Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and so forth, are these giant tomes.
Giant books,
The
yeah.
reason was because people who read them at those times didn't have a vision of the world. They didn't have television or movies. So Dostoevsky, when he talks
you have
about,
to explain. You
a,
have to,
a room is just a three-page description
yes,
of the
exactly,
room.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
You must have the same problem.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Because what you're describing is a world that none of us have ever seen.
Right. I mean, what I have said to people is that every animal around today was around then, but many have become extinct. I mean, there's no more mammoths.
Right.
There's no more cave bears. You know, I mean, and there's a lot of those, you know, animals that are, there's no more saber-tooth in this country either. Right. Or sloths, giant sloths,
oh,
right?
Or short-faced bears, yeah. Short-faced bears, you know.
Yeah.
All of those dire wolves, all of those, oh, right. You know. So, you know, we can kind of get a sense of what they're like. But all the animals that are here today, I mean, even, there's actually a place in France that you can go. And it's a explanatory place. There's a park there that has animals and stuff like that. There's a little museum there. And it's basically it's trying to explain Lascaux, the cave of Lascaux.
Mm.
And so they have been back breeding cattle. And they've got these now sort of reddish brown coat, solid color.
Really?
With your height, six and a half feet tall at the withers, at the shoulders.
Oh my God.
They're huge. You still look at them, you know they're a cow.
Right.
But they're the original, you know. They backbred them into that, yes. And they've been backbreeding horses. There
smaller
was actually
smaller.
No, yeah. No. They're actually the natural wild horse is about the size of a Mustang, which are a short horse, but they're not a pony. They're not now ancient ones.
Okay.
If you're talking about the whole from the beginning of their evolution. They were like, you know, the size of puppies.
I have to go back on something. When you're talking about singing and getting your languaging so that it's smooth, right? You know, Steinbeck
uh-huh.
would always read his books out loud because he wanted that meter. He wanted that good sounding singing, which goes right back to our most ancient, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey or the Bhagavad Gita or
yeah.
any of the ancient works were all oral works memorized
yes.
by one person, 8,000 lines of, you know, of
but that's the only way it could be passed
exactly.
down. We weren't writing.
Yeah.
They weren't writing.
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah, there are some implements, some bones, some antlers and so on. That have marks that may be counting marks.
Right.
They could well be counting marks. Could be the beginnings of writing and the beginnings of counting, but it's not there yet.
No.
So they have to memorize it.
So this leads me to one of my favorite questions to ask writers, and you're just incredible for this because you got a beginning, middle, and end. Where do you think writing is going? Given the changes with technology, in our culture.
And people texting now, you know, oh, OMG, oh my God.
Right.
And I haven't done that. I don't use the text. My daughter does, my secretary right. daughter. She's always, you know, on her cell phone talking to her kids and so on. You know, and they're always working it out. I mean, and I have purposely decided not to do that. Mm-hmm. And the reason is very, very good. I know myself. I can start reading a dictionary and get distracted looking up other words, you know? I mean, all of a sudden, it's an hour later, I'm still reading this damn dictionary,
right.
you know?
Right.
So I just know that if I had let myself get involved with the internet, I'd be pulled all, I'd be wanting to find out more and doing this and doing that. And I don't use it for research because I don't know who wrote that stuff.
Mm.
And I don't trust it. So, you know, if I see it's by somebody that I know, even if I just know of them, if I know it's a professional, you know, a trained archaeologist, then fine. And even then, if it's one of those like what is it, Wikipedia, where they can change things, thank you, no, I'm not going to trust that for my research.
Right.
That's why I have the books. And the only reason that I would know, even if I saw it on the internet, is because I'd read about them. You know, so I just said, okay, I am not going to let myself get involved with the internet because I'm not willing to give one of my books to the internet. And that's what would have happened. I would have been so distracted and so carried away that I never would have, you know, I mean, it would have taken even longer. And it takes me long enough as it is, you know. And as part of that's just as I'm getting older, I'm slower. I don't have the stamina to put in 16 hours a day, 7 days a week anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard work.
It is.
So.
But 30,000 years ago, sitting around on the plains of Europe, storytellers had a style and way
of
telling stories.
Oh, yeah. And I even have traveling storytellers in my books.
Yeah?
That go from place to place.
Right, right.
In the last book in particular.
And in fact, that's sort of what we consider ourselves to be doing. So where are we going with writing and stories? Do you know?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
You know? I think there's not going to be any end to storytelling.
Let's hope.
I think storytelling is how we communicate. And even on the news, they say it's a news story.
Yeah.
You know.
What advice would you give to new writers?
The way to write is to write and to read. That's exactly what you've got to, you know, first of all, you sit down and write. And if it doesn't come out right the first time, fine, rewrite it. And don't be afraid to rewrite. I have a good friend who would really like to get, he's never been published, he's a good poet. He's been published with his poetry. But he's tried to write a novel, and he's written several, but he won't rewrite.
Wow.
And he thinks, you know, well, you know, you get the first, there's that, some people have the idea that, their first idea is it.
Mm-hmm.
I like rewriting. Rewriting to me is when I get control of the story.
Ah.
You know, when it first comes out, it's like you're having an orgasm of the mind, you know. if it's really coming. Sometimes you have to pull it out like pulling teeth. One word right after another, you know, and you just keep at it because you know I never get a writer's block. And the reason is because when things are slow, I'd still sit down and pull it out one hard word after another. And that's how you do it, you know, and then all of a sudden it starts flowing again, you know. But you don't say, oh, I can't write now, I've got writer's block. You just sit your butt on the chair in front of your machine or in front of your desk and you write it.
That's right. Your characters are very real, and they've lived with you now for 40 years.
Oh,
Ayla
yeah.
has been there for a long time.
She's been a good friend.
That's my question. How live are they in your life? Do they ever direct the action themselves?
Oh, they always direct the action themselves when I'm writing. I mean, they tell me what they're doing, and it's mainly because once you have defined a set of characteristics for a character, then, I mean, if a person is naturally easygoing and so on, You're not going to suddenly make them go into a tantrum, because that's not what their character has defined. Or if somebody is very excitable, you know, then you've got to go ahead and show them that way. And each character, once you've got those characteristics defined for them, then they tell you what they should do, you know. This is a Neanderthal, and this is the old man of La Chapelle.
Wow.
And it's a, you know, obviously it's a cast.
Right.
And it was in a museum catalog.
Really? I hadn't seen.
And my kids found this museum catalog, and they decided to get me. I mean, I almost cried. I was so excited.
Yeah.
I mean, they couldn't have gotten me a better present. There we go. It's fun because you can see, first of all, when I describe them as flatheads.
Right.
Because it really goes immediately. We've got this,
right.
You know. Mm-hmm. They don't have that. But their skull capacity is larger than ours.
1,600 cc's up to.
The one, you know, the old man, I mean, the Kreb character, yeah. I based him on a skull. He was 1,800 cubic centimeters. Yes.
Now, okay, what part of the brain was larger? Was it the rear?
Yeah, and of course they've got the occipital bun besides.
Right.
But yeah, they had more. But, you know, of course there's this, what's his name again, who has been studying old skulls like this. And he thinks that maybe there wasn't that much difference, that it was just kind of shoved down. But I don't see the frontal lobes, you know.
No, I mean the frontal lobe and the prominent brow bones, both are consistent throughout all that I've read of.
Yeah.
And I'm only an amateur. I mean, if I told you this was actually, we were here from the future, this is a time machine, would you like to go back there to meet this guy? Would you do it?
Yes, so long as I can come back again.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, there's two-way
I don't
want to
stay there. Yeah, two-way stretch. Oh, yeah.
Oh.
In a heartbeat. But then I'd go to the moon in a heartbeat, too.
Yeah.
There he is.
He's wonderful.
Isn't he a wonderful guy?
He is. So when you create your characters, do you do do you create your characters separately from your book? Or do
they happen in the book, but then I have a section called characters. And when I have one that finds its way into the book, I put their name, I add their name, and if they happen to be a bigger role, I start adding the characteristics. Like, there's been a lot of interesting coincidences that I've invented something and then later found that it was real. For example, I decided to, you know, in the third book, in The Mammoth Hunters, there's a black character. And in that story, he's there. But so I invented this because I had read about what they call the Grimaldi Negroes, which are, they were found in this cave that's right on the border of, they're in France, but they're basically just on the border with Italy. And we went there, and, you know, I'm trying to find what's the name of that cave again? Anyway, I'm trying to find the cave. So we were finally getting across the point that I was looking for this site, this Grimaldi site was the name of it. And they supposedly at that site found two skeletons. One was an older woman and one was a teenage boy, and they were buried together, like spooning, you know, except. And they think that they were probably a mother and son. And they're saying that they call them the Grimaldi Negroids because, you know, you can tell from, like for example, the length of the bones.
Right.
You can tell from the, there's a sort of a lower jaw prognathism in Negroids. Or in blacks, or whatever you want to call them, but the technical term, of course, was Negroid, Caucasoid Negroid.
Right.
And so I thought, okay. And they don't know what they were doing there, but they did find him. So I thought, okay, if they could be in Italy, if they've moved up from Africa, and there's a, you know, there's some from Italy, well, okay, why couldn't they why couldn't they be in Russia? So I decided to put this half black character in the story. The backstory for him is that when they get into the mammoth hunters and they're staying at this one site that they call the Lion Camp, which is actually an actual site, and the woman who's the expert on those Eastern European sites, Eastern Russian sites, are, she says, you know, she loves my books because she says they always do France, they never do, you know. and
that actually is more likely the cradle.
Yeah, and it's so she's, you know, Kostyenki, that's the site. And so I had called her, you know, and we were talking, and she mentioned that, yeah, well, you use the skeleton that they found at Kostyenki in that book. And I said, what character? What skeleton? And she said, well, you know, the black skeleton, the half-black skeleton. And I said, I didn't know there was any black skeleton, and I invented that character.
Wow.
And she said, no. And I said, well, Olga, her name is Olga Sofer, do me a favor, and will you send me some information on it, a little explanation? So she called me about 3 weeks later, and she said, well, I've been looking, and I can't find anything in English. It's all in Russian. So this invention that I made, based on what to me was a logical extrapolation.
Right.
And he actually existed, and he was a half black, just as I had him. And so, you know, I've now,
fascinating,
I've gone to a couple of conferences where there's a couple of archaeologists who are just now talking about him. And I said, yeah, I wrote about him in the Mammoth Hunters.
That's wonderful.
And that kind of stuff has happened a few times.
Yeah.
Because, and I think it's because to me it's just logical extrapolation.
Yeah.
And that was why I had interbreeding too.
Jean, you have just been wonderful and spectacular, and I wish that we had 20 more hours of tape.
No. And I really can't talk anymore either because I'm going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even the storytellers in the caves had to finally say, I'm running out of juice.
Yeah, or that's the end of the story.
This is the end, yeah. Right.
So.
Can't thank you enough.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's been a real pleasure.
I hope you have fun with it.
Oh, guaranteed.